Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, June 7th, 2011 Carver Board of Aldermen meeting. This is a regular business meeting, so the first item on our agenda is a request from visitors and speakers from the floor. Ellen Perry, if you would come up to the mic.
Thank you all, guys.
I am very concerned about the state budget, as is everybody. But it's going to affect the population in a real bad way. If the state has their way, it will go, the 1915 D.C. waiver will go through. And we've stopped it a little bit, but we need to slow it down a whole lot more. So I don't know how to ask or if you all have any power to slow it down any more than we have already. But we need to slow the 1915 BC waiver down a whole lot. It's an innovations waiver, and it's not innovation. It's going back to the 19th century or the 18th century. But we're hidden away, and we can't be hidden away anymore. We're not hidden away. So, they might as well learn to live with us. So, is there any way that y'all can do it? Write a letter to Elian Varola and Joe Hackney and the representatives and everything else. I've written letters. Now it's time for y'all to.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
If it's sense of board, we'll.
Yes.
The mayor's office will get a letter together on this subject.
ASAP.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a crucial time.
But just know, Ellen, it may be a done deal. That's
I know it is, but if we can slow it down a little bit, yeah, it'd be great.
At least they'll hear from us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
All right. Are there any but other people who are here to speak on matters that are not on our printed agenda? If not, brings us to, yes. Actually, we have a proclamation.
There you go.
Real quick. Do you want to come up and join me? This will just take a moment, but whereas parks and recreation programs are an integral part of communities throughout this country, including Carborough, and whereas our parks and recreation are vitally important to establishing and maintaining the quality of life in our communities, ensuring the health of all citizens, and contributing to the economic and environmental well-being of a community and region, and whereas parks and recreation programs build healthy, active communities that aid in the prevention of chronic disease, provide therapeutic recreation services for those who are mentally or physically disabled, and also improve the mental and emotional health of all citizens. And whereas parks and recreation programs increase the community's economic prosperity through increased property values, expansion of local tax base, increased tourism, attraction and retention of businesses, and crime reduction. And whereas parks and recreation areas are fundamental to the environmental well-being of our community, and whereas parks and natural recreation areas improve water quality, protect groundwater, prevent flooding, improve the quality of air we breathe, provide vegetative buffers to development, and provide habitat for wildlife, and whereas our parks and natural recreation areas ensure the ecological beauty of our community and provide a place for children and adults to connect with nature and recreate outdoors. And whereas Town of Carborough recognizes the benefits derived from parks and recreation resources, now therefore be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, Mayor of Town of Carborough, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the month of July 2011 as Parks and Recreation Month and encourage all citizens to celebrate the occasion and recognize the staff of the Town of Carborough Recreation and Parks Department. They really appreciate it. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
Item 1 is approval of minutes of the previous meetings of May 17th and May 24th. Item 2 is appointments to the Planning Board, Environmental Advisory Board, and the Arts Committee.
Move the items.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Item passes unanimously. Item D1, Chapel Hill Transit Bus Rapid Discussion.
The board is asked to discuss a proposal from Chapel Hill Transit staff to investigate the use of bus wraps to generate advertising revenues for the bus system. And Steve Spade, the Chapel Hill Transit Director, is here again. Steve, you're making this a habit.
I am.
That's right. So, welcome, Steve.
It is home.
Steve Spade is among those many shining stars of the Chapel Hill Town staff who live in Carborough.
Yay.
There are a number of us. Right. We were just across the street here the other couple hours ago. What I'd like to do is share some information about transit advertising today. Let me see if I can work this thing. But before I talk about transit advertising, I'd like to spend a little time talking about our budget so that you understand the circumstances and conditions under which we're talking about transit advertising. This is a concept that's been discussed, at least in Chapel Hill, several times over the past decade. And we bring it up again now because of some of our budget issues and the changing economic climate. And so I want to set the stage for the discussion that you're really focused on, which is the transit advertising, by talking a little bit about the budget. So what I'd like to do is talk about some of the process that we've gone through with the transit partners, summarize the budget, and talk about some of the strategies we've got. And at the end of that discussion, then talk about transit advertising and how we view moving forward with that. First, let me talk about some of the trends in our budgeting. When we look at our transit expenses, they normally grow at a rate of about 7% per year. If you track historic trends at Chapel Transit and most other urban transit systems, you'll see that that's a pretty common trend. And so as we start to project forward on our operating expenses, it also tends to work out that way. This is 7% annual growth without any change in staffing, service levels, or anything else. A financial analysis done by the town, as they're looking at the trends for transit, the town of Chapel Hill in this year's budget projected that with no change in the way we fund the system and operate the system by fiscal year 14, that they'll need to raise taxes in order to support the system. Diesel fuel is a significant issue. It affects everybody. We burn 660,000 gallons a year. It's almost a $2 million expense for us. So when every time the price of fuel changes a penny, it's $7,000 in our budget. So it's a pretty significant impact on us. This year's budget, we were fortunate to contract for $2.99 a gallon for the first 6 months, but what happens the next 6 months are still up in the air for us. Our ridership obviously continues to grow, puts stress on the system, which is a good thing. I'd much rather have that problem as opposed to wondering where the riders are. Another huge issue for us and a trend that we're facing is the fact that our fleet's aging. We had a vehicle replacement program 5 years ago that said we needed to replace 45 buses in 5 years. We replaced 37 and can find no more federal money. We also have 37 buses today that are beyond 12 years old, need to be replaced. One of the things that happens is as your fleet gets older, your operating expenses continue to grow at a faster rate, and your service dependability starts to suffer, so our image, our ridership, and all those things suffer. Some of the issues that we faced this year in developing the budget is trying to keep up with the growth in cost. If our budget grows by 7% a year and we're looking at stable or declining revenues and there's a desire to hold the contributions of the partners whole or even with no increase, that puts the budget in a bind on how we're going to deal with that 7%. The other thing that we've facing this year is the needs of vehicle replacement. We have a goal to maintain an average fleet age of 7 years. We need to purchase 8 or 9 buses a year, and we're falling behind on that. So making sure that we're in a position, finding money or being in a position to buy buses is really important. A couple other issues we dealt with, obviously, were the fuel prices and how they're going to impact the budget. We're in a little better shape than we were a month ago, but we still have 6 months of our budget left to figure out. It looks like our state funding is going to be cut. The latest budget shows a 6% reduction in funding. We had originally projected that it would be 10. But we've also just found out that we are going to have about a 1% reduction in our federal funding, so that we hadn't anticipated. Local construction project detours are going to impact us now and will in the future. The Columbia Street construction project, in order for us to detour around that, it will cost us about $1.2 million in additional cost. It's really significant when you're running full buses that we can't run fewer buses because it takes longer. We have to actually put additional vehicles into service, and about 70% of our system runs up and down Columbia. So it's going to be a huge impact. The Umstead detour that's going on now is costing us about $200,000 for an 8-month project. So those are things that are not in the budget that we don't have control over. Maintenance costs are starting to go up with the aging fleet, so we need to start taking a look at what's the best way to start dealing with those issues. Another issue that we've at least put on the docket for discussion among the partners is the proposed half-cent local option sales tax. That plan that you were you received a couple weeks ago from Triangle Transit shows improvements in bus service, but we also believe that a little different interpretation of the use of that half-cent sales tax would allow you to use the revenues from that half-cent sales tax to offset the growth in the system as long as we maintain constant funding levels. We believe that's the meaning of do not supplant, and as opposed to requiring us to provide new services. At some point, as we're allowed to have that discussion moves forward, we think that could have a long-term impact on your ability to fund this budget if you could divert part of that to take that 7% growth in cost.
Steve, who would make that decision? The partners or a discussion or negotiations
with Triangle Transit?
That would have to come through the development of the bus plan and the negotiations on the financial plan that comes through the MPO.
It's partly a matter of statutory interpretation, though,
right.
So, you know, I guess theoretically who could end up deciding it, but of course, but.
And we've had a little different interpretation. We're in the minority in that. We've had a little different interpretation of what the statutory requirement is of the clause do not supplant. And thus far, all the other folks involved in developing the plan have agreed that it needs to be spent for new services. So what we've done in this plan is tried to keep on the table that issue in case we want to reopen it at some point in time. As you'll see this slide about 4 times in here. I was looking over the slide a little bit ago, and I apologize, but it is an important point. It keeps popping up. The way we develop our budget right now is that we work through the partners committee, and we start working in January and February, developing budget input for the partners to take a look at, so the Carborough, the town, and the university can make sure they are aware of what our issues are in the budget. So we start having budget talks really early in the process so all the partners are fully engaged in the issues. Last year, when we developed our budget, the partners wanted to maintain constant funding levels to have no change in local funding from the year prior. And they also wanted to minimize the use of fund balance to balance the budget. And in last year's budget, we held the line on local cost, and at the same time, we used about $900,000 of fund balance. At that time, the partners said, look, we need to begin developing a sustainable budget. And so as we are developing our budgets moving forward, we really need to keep an eye on building something that's not going to rely on us having to keep dipping into our savings, because that savings is also the money we use to buy new buses with. So as we began to develop this year's budget, that was one of the real goals we had from the partners. Then we also had, again, these same priorities to hold our funding levels constant at the FY 10-11, which is also the same as the 9-10 budget levels. They want us to take a look at doing what we could to make the services efficient. If we've got things that aren't producing, recommend changes. Take a look at new sources of revenue where possible and minimize the use of fund balance. So as we've developed the budget, we've tried to keep those things in mind. We presented the partners with a draft budget in March, and this was a budget that we shared with the partners before we got into the town budgeting process. That budget assumed the continued operation of services at their current level, no changes in staff level, and we projected about a 7% increase. It came in at about $18.65 million for FY 12, which is about $1 million higher than the current FY 10-11 budget. And as you can see here, these are the significant causes for the increase. Diesel fuel was projected at $3.09 a gallon instead of $2.45 a gallon. Our vehicle maintenance costs are up. Medical insurance is up. And the tire costs are almost double. And the reason for that is that it's a petroleum-based product, and everything that's related to petroleum now is going through the roof. So, but those, as you can see, those are things we don't have a lot of control over. And as a matter of fact, 94% of our budget is wages, maintenance and repairs, fuel, insurance, utilities, benefits, things that we don't have control over. So we're a labor-intensive business. So we gave the partners this budget, and then this was the revenue projections that we had. Now, the federal operating assistance is going to drop to about $1.8 million. State assistance is going to be down 6% instead of 10%. The STPDA funds are planning funds that come through the MPO. We had a little over $1 million, and we've used that to support a lot of our staff planning activities. That money's gone after this year. And then again, you see the partner contributions that that we've projected in this year's budget, which is holding the line on the partner costs. So the result was a $2.3 million gap between the operating expenses that were projected for no change in service and what we had in revenues. So we began, based on these priorities, to make some suggestions to the partners on how we might balance the budget using fund balance, service reductions, and new sources. And, of course, this is that same slide, trying to create a sustainable budget. Talk a little bit about each of these to give you a sense of some of the discussions we had with the partners. We have a fund balance of $4.1 million. That's a balance that we've accumulated over the past 5 years. The fund balance primarily is used to provide the 20% local match to buy buses. Today, we have a $15 million need for bus replacement, and if we were to be able to come up with that kind of federal money, it would take $3 million in local match in order for us to buy the buses. So you can see that this year, on the current needs, we already need $3 million. Next year, when we need $62 million or 62 buses replaced, the need gets even greater. So we're really kind of stingy about that fund balance. Yeah.
How much is a bus, like the big accordion buses?
Our buses range. The 40-foot standard diesel bus is about $380,000. The 40-foot hybrid bus runs about $529,000. and the hybrid, which is the more expensive of the articulated buses, is a little over
$900,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's a significant investment. And what we're doing now is focusing on buying straight diesel 40-foot buses because we can't afford the $200,000 upcharge for the hybrid electric.
So while a fund balance of $4.1 million looks wow, it's really not.
Well, that's our point with the partners. And the partners have been really cognizant of the point that we need to make sure we've got some money in the bank because if the feds or the state comes up with, like this year, the state said, we're going to give you $740,000 to buy some new buses. Can you match it? If we didn't have that fund balance, then we would have. Greensboro or somebody else would have gotten that money.
Steve, I know it's not the main thrust of your presentation here, but what's leading to the circumstance where we can't get any federal money to help with bus capital?
It's really the difficulty in trying to earmark, the fact that earmarks are tougher to get. Mm-hmm. We have to get discretionary money because there's not enough formula money.
Okay.
And so we need to be more effective with our members of Congress to get money earmarked. We need to be more proactive with our state DOT. It's interesting that the state budget takes $70 million out of the DOT budget and buys school buses. Yet we're just one example of all the transit systems in the state that are dying on the vine because we can't afford to buy new buses. Mm-hmm. So we need to make a lot more noise at the state and the federal level.
Just following up on that for 1 second. The federal situation, it's it's a question of they're trying to crack down supposedly universally on federal earmarks.
Right.
That's the situation.
And they're putting more money into different discretionary programs. So you see all the creative DOT grant programs that are really taking that discretionary money and putting it back into what they call a new program that gives the FTA administrators more discretion over where that money's going and gives our congressional delegation less control. Yeah. So
I was under the impression that our transit system here was one of the highest volume transit systems in the state. Wouldn't that
count in terms of prioritizing
federal dollars?
You would think, but it helps, obviously, to be the second largest system and the 18th largest community. But part of the challenge is that the dollars are so thin and there's so much demand for them that it's really who's the most effective at making our point with our legislators, both at the state and the federal level. So we've got to get much more active trying to
leave that there.
Yeah.
Tell us about
it. It's a whole other issue. Yeah.
Okay.
But what we've tried to understand is that the short-term use of fund balance can create some long-term problems, not only not having the money for capital, but if we spend, and you'll see in a minute, we want to spend $1.3 million of the fund balance to support this year's budget. But that means that next year, you've got to eat the cost of the $1.3 million plus the 7% growth.
Wow.
But we just wiped out the fund balance in 2 years. So there's a real concern about managing this. So then we start looking at new sources of revenue. We looked at transit advertising, which obviously is the topic tonight. We had a discussion about, and it's, you know, we always get these at public input sessions, which is, well, watch charge fares again. But the real issue is that we aren't a fare-free system. We're a prepaid system, and the university, when we went fare-free, went from about a $3 million contribution to a $6 million contribution a year, and they actually prepay the fares for their employees and the students. So if we went to start charging a fare, they would have to pass that cost back on to the students and staff, which would cause decreases in ridership. The other thing is that the towns only lost about $250,000 in cash revenue when we went fare free, and we've made that up in growth in our other subsidies. We've talked about parking fees and park and ride lots. I know that's an issue that We'll be talking with the folks in Carrboro about, university has a five-year plan that involves charging staff to park at park and ride lots as a way of generating money to support the transit system. We think that it probably makes sense for us to do it. One of the interesting things here is that a lot of, the vast majority of the people that use the park and ride lots are coming from outside our jurisdiction. So this is a way to generate revenues from people that aren't paying taxes in our community to support the system now. So there's something that makes sense, but this would probably not happen until 2014.
Let me ask you a question. Since I am a user of a park and ride lot, and I pay my taxes, would the partners consider maybe a waiver or a reduction for those folks who have already made their contribution when they wrote their property?
I think that, I mean, those are all things that obviously we can talk about and need to be talked about as we, there are a number of concerns. One is, what about residents that are using it now that are paying taxes? The other is, how does, and this is a big issue with Carrboro and Chapel Hill, how does charging people to park in a park and ride lot affect other areas? Parking downtown Carrboro, parking in neighborhoods around park and ride lots. So there's a lot of discussion that goes on, needs to go on about how to manage this.
That's a good
point. Yeah, so the university's come up with this idea, and it's part of their plan. We're going to have to address it, but they just kind of opened the door for the discussions. I think it'll be it's something we can resolve, but we're going to need to work on it.
The park and ride lot in Carrboro near Jones Ferry Road. Yeah, who owns that?
We do Chapel Transit, the partner. I think it might actually legally be a town piece of property. Now the university pays for the service out of that area, but as we deal with this issue, we're going to deal with it from the Chapel Hill Transit, the holistic perspective of how it affects all the parties.
I'm just curious about that.
Again, we think the half-cent local option sales tax has some long-term options. Also, vehicle registration fees. There are some in the recent legislation, the House Bill, Senate Bill 148, but also we could always consider going back to the legislature and asking for authority to raise vehicle registration fees, although, again, that's another long-term thing. And if you look at the revenues that generate, it's another $200,000-$400,000, so it makes a difference, but it's not the big kind of thing like you might see at the half-cent sales tax. We looked at service reductions. Again, I don't want to get into a lot of detail on that. We just finished a public input session about a half an hour ago on this, but what we did as staff was we took a comprehensive operations analysis we were doing to gather data on the system and use the information from that to recommend a series of service improvements based on system performance. Our goal when we first handed this off to staff was to eliminate the $2.3 million gap, and they came back and said, we don't feel comfortable going beyond $900,000. So what we suggested to the partners was $884,000 worth of service cuts. That, by the way, we made the point that if they're going to impact the budget significantly, we need to make the decision in June so the service changes can happen in August. Otherwise, we don't realize the savings, and that $880,000 has to come from somewhere else. So, it's been a fun budget this year. So the budget that we recommended, that we ended up crafting to recommend in the town budget process, went from $18.6 to $17.6 million, revenues of $16.3 million. No increase in tax rate in the town and no increase in cost for the other partners. It includes $884,000 of service reduction, so that's already factored into the budget, and recommends almost $1.3 million in use of fund balance. Now, it doesn't include transit advertising because we knew the partners wanted to get engaged in a discussion on that, so we've not included transit advertising revenues as part of the budget. So now you kind of got the budget. I'm sorry to drone on about that, but I think it's important background to have as we talk about transit advertising. Here, just quickly, are the service reductions that we're looking at. These are low-impact reductions. You can see we're all over the place. A lot of this is first and last trip of the day. Moderate are changes in which the alternatives that people have aren't quite as convenient. But again, you'll see that we're reducing the G route to hourly service, eliminating trips on a lot of the express routes. And then we had some significant decreases in service. One is ratcheting back the demand response service, Easy Rider, to what we're obligated to do by federal mandate, which is to bring ourselves into compliance with ADA service. This means that on Sunday, our service would be serving an area about 3/4 mile wide on either side of Martin Luther King Drive. And it would, instead of operating at 9:30 in the morning, it wouldn't start till about 11 o'clock in the morning. The A route, Piney Mountain loop through the neighborhoods would be gone. The G route would be gone past Glen Lennox. And the HS route that we just added a while back would be eliminated midday. So these are some fairly significant service cuts, but this is the kind of thing we're getting into in this kind of a productive system.
Can you go back one slide for just a second? Let me just look at that list.
I'll try. Yep.
So notably, we're losing the first and last trip on the F bus.
Right.
In Carrboro.
And
the first trip on CW.
Right. A lot of the first trips in the morning that run virtually empty are the worst producing trips in the system.
And were there impacts on the J route?
I don't think we did much on it. If it were very minor,
it's on the slide.
There might have been one on the first slide of the day.
Last
The last midnight trip. The midnight trip.
The midnight J.
Midnight special.
All right.
For the next slide, how many people are impacted on an average?
You know, we have a spreadsheet. I don't have it in front of me, but I can. I'd be happy to email you a spreadsheet that shows each route, the service, the miles we save, and the passengers affected.
That'd be helpful.
I can.
You know, Mark, you were bringing up the J route and the Carrboro route. I also, just by point of reference, the high school route is the one that goes up Rogers Road. And so it's talking about pulling out the midday routes. So I know our neighborhoods up there have been getting noticed about that, too.
Yeah. Let me just add, in terms of background, that at the partners meeting, you know, we were presented with this spreadsheet Steve's referring to, and it basically took a threshold of service in terms of threshold of ridership. And I think that the approach I took in my sense of the group was that we recognize the need for the savings in this current economy, and we didn't really try and, like, cherry pick or analyze the routes or the stops or anything like that. We just said, you know, if it's at that level of service, then we just need to bite the bullet this year and make those reductions. And so that was kind of what led to the list that you're seeing.
And we're in the process now of getting public input. We completed the fourth of six public input sessions today. It was held over at Carver Elementary, and we have two more tomorrow, and we'll be done. We've received close to 150 emails, phone calls, letters from people with concern. What we'll do is take that information, and if there's something really significant that jumps out at us, then we'll try to respond in a way to mitigate. If we don't get comments, then we're going to assume that folks are okay with it and move ahead.
People know enough to, you know, be okay with it, but...
Do the buses themselves have advertisements of these meetings?
We put flyers on the buses at the bus stops. Any email lists or anything we've got, we put public notice, obviously, in the papers. Neighborhood groups, and believe me, some of the neighborhoods that are affected have it on their listserv. The word's out. Yeah. Orange County Politics, I think. Orange Politics.
Yeah, they're having that.
Great time. Yeah.
So that leads us to, you kind of understand where we are. Here's this same slide again, I'm sorry. It all kind of, but again, the budgets today require a little different approach. In this economic climate, we're watching our local tax dollars decline, state and federal dollars decline, our costs go up. We got to do things differently. And so we've been trying, obviously, to look at new ways of bringing money in to sustain the budget and to fit with these goals for the partners. We think that transit advertising was one of those things that could benefit us. And what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about why transit advertising, what it is, and then walk you through our process that we went through with the partners in at least opening up this discussion. We think there are some advantages to transit advertising. One is it not only is it another source of revenue, but it's an alternative source to relying on tax dollars. So every dollar we can bring in through sale of advertising is $1 less that we have to pass on to our local taxpayers. It also adds diversity. We believe that in the management of the transit system, and I think the town's probably the same way, if you focus all your needs on property tax or sales tax, that as situations change, you find yourself vulnerable. So we really need to do whatever we can to diversify our funding sources, and this is a way of doing that. When you look at advertising opportunities, transit advertising is usually less expensive than TV advertising and newspaper advertising and billboard advertising. We'll price the medium competitively, so the local advertisers that want to advertise might find this is something that becomes advantageous to them as opposed to other stuff. It's also more targeted. So if you buy an ad in the Herald Sun, it's all over the place. You buy a transit ad, if this is your market, it's going to be more effective in hitting people here. So there's some advantages to locals. And transit advertising, as you'll see, can also be used to support community activities. Transit advertising started in the 1800s as just signs on the sides of the buses, and now it's evolved into all kinds of different things. If you look at websites on transit advertising, you'll find 15 or 20 different mediums of transit advertising. We are focusing our discussions on two of them. That is the total bus wrap and bus exterior signs that would go either on the curbside or the street side or the rear of the bus. There's a shelter in here with advertising, but we're not. There are a number of reasons we don't think it's something that ought to be considered now. But it is another traditional type of transit advertising. These are some examples of bus wraps. So you see what they look like. The bottom one is one that was done by a transportation management association in the community to promote safe sharing the road. And again, this is the kind of thing that can be used to share or push community priorities. And
does that actually cover the windows the way it appears?
The vinyl on the outside on the windows actually has perforations in it, little holes. So when you're outside, it looks like this. When you're inside, you can see out of it. It's like looking through tinted glass. So you can still see out, and you can actually vary to a certain degree the size of the perforation, so it's easier to see out if you've got an issue with that.
How many bikers try to join that critical mass?
They get your attention. These are some examples of exterior signs, and I'm sure you've seen these kinds of things. But this is, we would be looking at the signs that are on the sides of the buses and the rears. Just to get
so these would be the queen or king or?
If they're on the curb side where you have the doors, they're queen size signs. If they're on the street side where there's no door, they're a king size sign. King size is 12 feet because there's doors in the way. You can't get as big a sign on the curb side. It's only 9 feet as opposed to, or whatever 130 inches is. And And these are examples of pretty decent signs in terms of their design also, the reason we showed them. In the development of this idea, we broached this idea early on our discussions with the partners and did a staff analysis of what we thought might be the potential. And again, knowing this has not been something that's got a lot of interest in the past, we wanted to test community interest, at least with the partners, before we did a lot of work. So we did a staff analysis that took a look at potential business models. About a year ago, we did an analysis of the different systems around North Carolina that have transit advertising, the rates, and how their programs are organized. We took a look at some potential rates, staffing levels, and projected revenues, and we then shared that information with the partners in a staff analysis form. In the early presentation to the partners, their determination was that it seems that transit advertising could be considered, or we ought to at least have the discussion about transit advertising and a long-term source of revenue, and they agreed that we ought to focus on exterior signs and bus wraps and not get into a lot of the different kinds of applications. And our analysis showed that we could net revenues that would range anywhere from $200,000 to $450,000 a year. This is an example of what we would suggest as transit advertising rates that we did in our first study. And as you can see, we tried to establish a program that's competitive with the programs here in the triangle. We threw the shelter advertising in there in the early analysis, thinking that we might consider it, and then we decided not to recommend it to the partners. We did four different options as we took a look at our projections. Each one of the options had a different combination of doing exterior signs and bus wraps, and assumed that at any one time 30% of the system was not sold, and then assumed that all the rates were sold at a six-month contract rate. Option number one said, well, what if we just did 100% of the fleet with signs and no bus wraps? Option number two said, what if we do bus signs on all the buses, but left the option to do 10 wrapped buses. Option three was doing add signs on all the buses, but having the option to do 15 wrapped buses. And then option four was, let's just do 15 wrapped buses. And the idea there was, well, let's just start with some of the older vehicles, wrap them, and see how it goes. And as you can see, we projected gross revenues that range from $270,000 a year to as high as $676,000 a year. And again, that's strictly based on selling 70% of the space at a six-month rate. The net revenues that drive...
I just want to confirm my math here that using the signs, it's about $7,000 per bus, is that right? And the wraps generate about $18,000?
The wraps generate $18,000 a year. I'd have to... Your math is probably...
Well, I was dividing 70 buses into 475. Is that about right?
If you say so. I mean, I could...
Well, is that 70%? Yeah. It's ballpark anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, the bus wraps, Jen, I mean, it's a high value media. The staffing that we talked about, well, there are really a couple different options on staffing. One was to, and I'll just go back to this so you can see the net revenues. One option is to
contract. The next one, I want to see the next one.
The next one?
Because those are costs. There you go.
Okay. One option is to contract, you should put on an RFP and let an ad agency come in and sell your space. The other is to hire internal staff and manage the process yourself. We recommended that we hire internal staff. The risks are that they don't sell anything and you don't get anything. but the upside is that whatever you do sell, you get to keep for yourself, and you're not under a contract. You're getting a small percentage of whatever the gross revenues are. The other thing is you have much better control over quality, because now as an employee of ours that lives here, works here, and is focused on making sure the job's done right, as opposed to somebody that comes in, sells whatever they can for 60 days and leaves again. So we much prefer to have a personal touch on the advertising. If you sell bus wraps only, you could do it with a part-time salesperson, because all they're doing is selling the bus wraps. You then use a firm to do the design. Somebody else prints the vinyl, and then they actually come in and apply the vinyl. So it takes no staff support to put it up, take it down. It's just simply selling. If you do bus wraps and signs, then we would need, it's a obviously a more aggressive thing, so you need full-time staff, and then you need a part-time person that can put signs up and take them down. And we think we could support it with a person that's working 20 or 25 hours a week. So we put together a budget based on that, and then used whichever was the appropriate staffing level to match up with these gross costs to come up with our net revenues. So that gives you a sense of where we are. So we then presented that to the partners and made an initial presentation to the town council and continued to get kind of positive nods, at least move to the next step. So what we've done now is taken another step, which is to develop a formal rate sheet that shows the variation of the rates that I think you all have, to revisit our staffing and make sure that we're comfortable with that, start to lay out again the business model and make sure that we're comfortable with that. And then we drafted policies and contract conditions. Here what you see are the policies and standards. We then have started to look at our marketing opportunities. Let me talk about each one of these last two just for a moment. First of all, the policies are really important because what we've got here is not a public forum, but it is a mechanism that we as the transit system and the partners are using to support the operation of the transit system. And so what we point out in our policies is that there's a tie between the integrity of the system, the integrity of the partners, and our ridership. And so we've got the right to control the medium because it's our image and it affects our ridership. And so we've got policies and we put policies in place that spell out that and say there are certain types of ads that we will not permit on our buses. And that gives us the ability then when somebody comes up with an ad that we don't think meets the criteria, it's obscene, offensive, it promotes illegal drugs or guns or whatever, that we've got the ability then to say we're not going to allow that on the buses.
Yeah. I like and appreciate that. My concern is how easy that would be to get politicized. I think it would be cut and dry if we don't want ads for, promoting alcoholic beverages to our youth. But say it was from an organization that maybe had political views that were very different from those of the majority of our community, I wouldn't want that kept off. And yet I could see where staff would say, well, if we put that up, then nobody's going to ride the bus, and so therefore we can say X political ideal can't go on the bus, and that's where I see running into some issues.
You can. I was in a system where I had transit advertising for a number of years, and you do run into some of those issues with the advertiser. And what you do in implementing the policy is you try to stay as issue neutral as you can.
Yeah.
Maybe an example. Planned Parenthood was an advertiser on our buses because they had a fundraiser book sale every year. And they were allowed to advertise that there was a Planned Parenthood book sale happening at the state fairgrounds, but they were not allowed to advertise anything about their issues. So that's a lot of times how those are managed.
But I can see that. I I'm watching our lawyer's face. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think that first of all, I mean, they're certainly making a strong effort to make it clear that this is not a public forum or even a designated public forum, but is a non-public forum. Now, how successful one will be in that, I'm not quite as sanguine, perhaps, as Steve is. I mean, the reality of it is that you got cases all over the place and these sorts of things get litigated. I think, in some respects, the safest thing to do is from dealing with it or not dealing with the issues that you're raising or the question that you're raising is perhaps, you know, just to say, well, we'll just take in only commercial advertising. We won't take issue advertising. We won't take political issue advertising. Now, I don't know what that does to the budget. I mean, that affects the budget. But, you know, some of the, I don't know, if you're going to, as soon as you allow that kind of advertising, I mean, again, some of the things that you say are concrete and clearly exclusive. But other matters where you're talking about things they want to accept things that affect the image of the Chapel Hill Transit, and I mean that means somebody's deciding that if it says, you know, it's one thing to advertise a book sale for Planned Parenthood, but the other says abortion is evil. I mean, does that negatively affect something, or is that? I mean, it's not. I don't see that kind of advertising as coming within any of the proscriptions here, unless one were to conclude that that's an image that threatens or adversely affects the public image of Chapel Hill Transit. And obviously the reason why it would is because people don't like the message. And as soon as you go there...
That's not a very good explanation.
So, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think... You know, the volume of litigation would suggest that these issues cannot be avoided if you accept, you know, issue advertising, basically, or if once you get beyond the commercial... And even maybe there, but I think the questions and issues are limited. But again, I don't know what that does to the budget. So,
but some commercial could be charged that way too. I mean,
true.
I mean, if you think of, let's say, some pharmaceutical company wants to put up, you know, some drug that Viagra.
Good choice.
I mean, no, I'm just saying, you turn on TV, you know, you see what I'm saying? So, that, I mean, where do you draw the line on what, how do you read what's commercial?
Well, I think Mike's point is exactly right. There has been litigation, there have been issues, and that's why you have the policy in place, and invariably somebody's going to test it, although... If you talk to Raleigh, Greensboro, a lot of these others, they've been doing advertising for years, and the issues that pop up are really minor, usually, and it's more we don't think this is right. Can you change your design? Can you change your reference? And a lot. So I think it's manageable, although he's exactly right. When you start doing transit advertising, you open the door to those kind of controversies.
But I'm just wondering about the question from the other way around, which is, so what kind of businesses are interested in having bus advertising in a college town? I mean, is it like Princeton Review? You know what I'm saying? I mean, what kinds of things are really out there that want to advertise in a community such as, you know, Chapel Hill Park?
Well, I look at the buses and the transit systems in the Triangle, look at the billboards in the Triangle, and you get a sense. Banking institutions, Nationwide Insurance.
TV stations.
TV radio stations. So those kinds of... and a lot of the billboard and transit advertising industry have regulated themselves knowing that there are things that aren't going to be permitted because they don't want to go through this. Now, when you step into the political realm, like Mike said, that's when you get into the issues is when you're most likely to run into a...
Well, beer. I'm thinking,
That's already covered there. The Daily Tar Heel used to be funded in part through student fees, and now it's entirely independent, so it's sort of a different issue. But back when it was, that where the sort of advertising propriety issue would come up was that periodically Playboy would want to advertise the hell out of their Girls of the ACC issue or whatever. I don't even know if they still publish Playboy. It's probably got a business. But what do you have something in there that kind of addresses that issue to some degree?
That wouldn't be something that was allowed in, under our policy.
So it's obvious that we need to diversify our revenue streams, so I'm not debating that.
Are we still on the policy of who we include? Because I have a point on that.
Yeah, I mean, mine's related, but if yours is more related, I'm just about to...
Just checking.
Mine could also go to the last point, so you should share yours, which is more related.
Okay, yeah. So in thinking about this, one thing I was wondering about is issues of sort of social responsibility of the advertisers beyond those kind of basic things you're outlining. And that can be a very complex question of how you define social responsibility and whether you can even, the extent to which you can legally build it into these guidelines. And one thing that occurred to me and this was actually because a citizen gave an example of some big national corporation who they thought wouldn't be good to have on the buses. And so I was reading about this corporation, and in the article I was reading, it made reference to some multi-million-dollar settlement they'd made on federal charges of such and such. So it occurred to me that a sort of very minimalist but effective criteria might be that someone not be a corporate criminal. And is that possible to include? And I guess the question is for you also, Mike, that, you know, if a corporation had paid billions of dollars to settle charges or had been convicted.
That's not the best measure, though.
It's not. I'm saying it's a minimalist measure. But, you know, and I'm just asking that as a basic question because that sort of, you know, it cuts out the need for a larger question about corporate responsibility, which I'm not saying we shouldn't have, but my view of any thought about that.
My opinion, obviously I haven't researched that, and nor have I seen something like that, but it seems to me that would be a permissible criteria of exclusion because it's viewpoint neutral, which is the key. Or a major element of it. In other words, it doesn't make any difference what viewpoint, or political or otherwise, the corporation is espousing. If they've been convicted of a crime, that they've been convicted of a crime. And it's also removes the element of discretion that often creates problems where you've got someone deciding whether or not something's consistent with the image of Chapel Hill or Carborough or the transit system or whatever that means. Mm-hmm. The difficulty with those kinds of generalities, obviously, is it easily is perceived to be a potential source of abuse in the sense of really constituting a viewpoint. The image issue it depends upon your viewpoint, doesn't it, as to whether something is consistent with Chapel Hill's image or Chapel Transit's image. It's a matter of, whether you think you... Well, you can see where I'm going with that. So, but I think your answer to your question, I would think something like that, when the criteria is specific and articulable like that, I don't think there's a problem with it.
Except.
Okay. I need a problem with it. We're coming back to CMA, I'll just remind you, but go ahead.
Well, there could be people in the community who own small businesses who have some kind of criminal conviction. I can think of...
I'm not talking about personal. I'm talking about the business.
Okay. Okay. We don't need to make those kind of decisions now, do we? One thing I do really like is that it's very, very affordable for our small businesses. If for $150 you can have a sign on the back of the bus for a month, that's great for our small businesses.
Yeah, so that's related to my point, which is obviously we need to diversify the revenue source, but also thinking in kind of our stand over time and the fact that we don't have billboards in towns and how this kind of fits within those policies. But also thinking about other things that we try to promote as a community, at least in Carrboro, is a local living economy, which is defined by supporting locally owned businesses. And so the issue of all of a sudden, I mean, we're already bombarded with information and media through mainstream sources, such as television and radio, but to then have it on the streets. And there's a reason why advertisers advertise on that, it has an effect. And so my question gets to whether we'd be able to define advertisement for locally owned businesses only. That would be possible.
Well, and that suggestion has obviously been made a couple times over the past month or so. As we take a look at the revenues needed and the opportunities, I don't think that limiting our sales to local businesses only would make this an economically viable program. I think you need to make it available to any advertisers that fit within our, obviously within our policies. That said, we think one of the nice things about having our own staff on board is that we could establish a program that we're going to place an emphasis on really going out and making sure all the local businesses know the opportunity, so that we could place an emphasis on trying to make this available to local advertisers. Another thing that we've considered of offering as part of this to each one of the partners is to suggest that we give each partner the use of a wrap bus for a year. If the partner then would need to do the design, produce the ad work, and get the bus wrapped, but you could then use that bus for a year either to promote your local businesses or to promote local activities or local issues or all of the above. That would maybe give you something of value that allows you to start to support businesses that might marginally be able to get involved in this. And at the same time, you can start to test the value of the medium also. So that's one of the, I guess those are the two things that we think we could do to support local businesses.
Let me just quickly follow up. The other option I was thinking we may be able to do, and I'd be curious to know why y'all aren't considering it anymore, is the shelter option. We've had that brought up, at least at our retreat, and I know on another occasion, I've been interested in seeing if there's ways in which to promote certain values that the town has, such as, well, buy public transport, buy local, reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, you know, walk, bike, but, you know, the WISE program. There's a lot of things or events that we have. So perhaps the bus shelters could be a place where that could happen. And I like the idea of dedicating maybe half could be for local businesses and the other half could be for...
Sure. You got two sides of the bus. You can do different sides. Let me just share our thoughts about shelters. Traditionally, it's really difficult to get shelter programs set up because of local sign ordinances. And then the other thing that we were concerned about is having too many options and diluting what we've got in the way of an opportunity. So our thinking was that we ought to start with buses, and if that's successful and we create more demand, we could move into shelters. Now, that said, if Carrboro were to say, we've got some great shelters here, we'd like to incorporate some advertising into them, that nothing to say that we couldn't work with the town specifically to implement the program to take advantage of the great shelters we've got here.
Yeah. Steve, if I'm hearing you correctly, Sammy, you're not talking about a revenue-producing advertising. You're talking about promoting certain town values
Town value.
Which is something very different than what you're talking about.
Okay.
I'm talking about revenue and the value sense of things.
Well, but not dollars in terms of closing that gap.
No. I mean, it would be kind of next best option if we did go down allowing some bigger businesses a means for counterbalancing that a bit, understanding that we would be generating a lot of revenue through these other means, but that the small amount of revenue that shelters would generate wouldn't be a revenue.
But to Sammy's point, though, you could have a program where local businesses or even other businesses had advertisements that promoted local values, but also promoted themselves somehow.
Then we get into a much longer project, because then you're talking about the sign ordinance.
Right.
Which we've got control over.
The question I was going to ask when you mentioned about the partners and the possible program with partners is whether or not local organizations such as the Chamber of Commerce or merchants groups could be approached, you know, to help support local businesses by getting into some kind of a wrap program as well. Has that been?
Well, I think you could do all kinds of things. If I understand what you're saying, as we develop the marketing strategy, one of the things obviously that we would do is work with the chamber to get the word out to local businesses that this is an opportunity. One of the things we would look for in our sales staff is also some design capabilities, so that as part of the working with the local businesses, our person would have the capability to do some design work so that they could help them see what a sign ought to look like if you do it right.
But, beyond, for example, the chamber that has folks that may or, well, I'm thinking of folks that may hang underneath the radar, folks who maybe through the farmers markets or the CSAs, mm-hmm. you know, that this would be a great way to promote, and this does get to some of the things we value most, but are always like hovering below the radar. There is a way to get, get these groups more involved. I mean, that I would really, that would be
one of the
interest to me.
One of the other things that you could do that we've done is like public service advertising, and we would have ads that were already produced, and we would use them on vacant space. So in a given month, if we had four or five buses that didn't have space, we would then post the public service ad. And there's nothing to say that we couldn't work with the partners to say, we'd like to promote the farmers market, so if we have any vacant space in March, we could have signs available that could help promote that. So that, I mean, those are all kinds of options. The other thing is partnering with cultural events. You might get a large advertiser that wants to do something in a civic way, so that they'll do the nationwide bus, but it'll promote some civic event that we've got going on too. So there are different partnerships that we can do.
What I'm hearing here is a lot of support for the idea, which I think is relatively new. I think that there are kinks to be worked out, and you know, can so-and-so and can not so-and-so. And I can see this becoming, anytime you run for office, you're going to have to buy one of these, just like, you know, just like an ad in the Indy.
We're not going to take political advertising.
Oh, okay, so there won't be political advertising. Good, because then there could be...
Yeah, $1,500 a month.
So no, they're not. The cheapest one's not that. Cheapest one's lower. Anyway, I think what we're hearing is a lot of support for the idea. When does the process of working out the details happen?
Well, we're trying to work on the details now. So as we get a positive nod, we're trying to take it to the next level. What I'm sensing here is that we ought to seek some input on what you feel we ought to have in the policies to improve your comfort level, maybe address in some kind of document the marketing ideas that we can use to help support local, and bring them back and see what y'all think of that.
Okay.
I'm recommending Monday, to the 13th, to the Chapel Hill Council. I'm asking them to approve the concept so that we could potentially implement it. Now, that raises the question of, is everybody on board? But at least we can get the council locked in on their opinion and come back and have some more discussions.
Okay. Are you asking them to approve a particular of the ABC's three plans?
We're recommending the 15 wraps and the full, all the signs. So it's the, and our thought is
that means up to 15 wraps.
Up to 15 wraps, and then selling the three signs on all of the fleet, knowing that it's going to take a while to ramp up. You know, we start to
know. The university is on board.
Yes, they are.
Well, they're on board because everybody's in a very constrained economic climate, and, you know, there are positives in it because we're not going to have liquor, we're not going to have tobacco, so.
No naked people.
And no people who don't have clothes.
And
there may not be.
So much for Paris of the Piedmont.
No tweets. Yeah.
The other thing I would hope we point out is, and we did have a little bit of that discussion earlier, is that this is another example of the effects and the ripples of policies at other levels. And this is why we as a town passed a resolution making that point not so long ago, where we're spending money towards war and towards not taxing the people who can most afford it, and all these cuts. And so it essentially comes down to these kinds of effects where we do see the privatization and the beginnings of privatization of everything ranging from schools to public transportation, and this visit very visibly. And I would warn us to take this as a possible trend and to do everything we can to address things and continue to address things on those other levels.
Yes.
The resolution for us is only to accept the report, so
yes.
I'd like to move the resolution.
Second.
Accepting the report. All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed? I pass unanimously.
Good discussion,
Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate your time and your patience.
We look forward to hearing.
Can we yarn bomb the bus too?
For $1,500 a month, yeah.
You don't yarn bomb buses.
That's a joke.
Don't yarn bomb buses.
Okay. Items D2, update on Carborough Impact Project.
You're being asked to receive an update on the Carborough Impacts project.
Jim, are you doing this? No. Okay.
That's quicker.
Hi, I'm Dolly. I work for the planning department here, and I'm the physical activity and health coordinator for the IMPACT project. IMPACT stands for Incentivizing More Physical Activity Through Carborough's Transportation System. It's solely a grant-funded project. The funds originated through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, funneled then through the Centers for Disease Control, and then through the North Carolina Physical Activity and Nutrition Branch. It was awarded to the town last July, and I've started this position this past January. The purpose of the project is to look at ways the built environment can increase physical activity within the town. So although Carborough is already very physically active, this presents an opportunity to kind of highlight some of the state and local policies that may affect physical activity, and also presents an opportunity for Carborough to become a town that highlights best practices. This grant was awarded to 11 municipalities within North Carolina, one of which is Carborough, and the mandatory deliverables include a case study and a local action plan. To date, some of the projects that we've completed are we have created an impacts team, which consists of 11 Carborough residents with varying degrees of expertise. We've also created a local action plan, which highlights local and state policies that can hinder or promote physical activity within the town. And with the help of the impacts team, we've identified various hot spots around town.
Hold that mic close.
Oh. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. We've identified hot spots around town that our pedestrians and cyclists may consider unsafe, which is part of our local action plan. We've also created a case study on Estes Park Apartments. So the majority of this case study highlighted various policies that affect Estes Park Apartments as well as other apartment complexes, perhaps in Carrboro. And also we highlighted some of the difficulty Estes Park Apartment residents may have in accessing other areas around town via walking or biking. We've also completed a day in the life bike tour. This happened several weeks ago. With the help of the impacts team, we looked at various areas around town and addressed the accessibility to perform utilitarian trips. So trips such as going to the grocery store, to the library, to school, and we've highlighted some of our findings within the local action plan. We've also hosted a Centers for Disease Control and North Carolina Pan Branch visit several weeks ago. So this, we took this visit to highlight some of Carrboro's pedestrian successes and several weaknesses. So notably, we took them on a trip using the sidewalks leading from Town Hall to Carrboro Elementary, then on Francis Shetley bike path. We drove out to Winmore Development, highlighting some of the mixed-use developments in the northern Carrboro area. And as weaknesses, we also took a drive on SD Drive Extension, highlighting some of the pedestrian difficulties there. Some of our future projects include a trail wayfinding sign workshop, so this is going to happen in the next few weeks. The grant funds approximately 10 signs, so with the help of the impacts team, hopefully the Greenways Commission and the Transportation Advisory Board, as well as other Carrboro residents, we're going to look at places around town that could benefit from increased signage. So either highlighting some bike paths, trails, greenways, possibly routes to downtown. We're also going to create fitness maps. So these will highlight 1, 3, and 5 mile walking, running, or cycling routes around town. Hopefully, this will kind of take away some of the barriers that people might feel to be active outside. We're also planning a promotional video for cycling, which we hope to showcase on either the town website or on other physically active-minded businesses around Carrboro and Chapel Hill. So I know that was a brief overview, but hopefully it was informative. This is a list of our impacts team, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
I had just two or three questions.
Yeah.
And one, I think it's great, especially it would be helpful to have a way for people to know, for example, from where their neighborhood is, what a 1 mile walk is, what a 2 mile walk is, what a 4 mile walk is, maybe like circle maps, sort of. The state started a program in April where we're walking to Lisbon, so I've been wearing my pedometer to work and writing down and then giving it to my team members so we can win and walk to Lisbon ahead of everyone. And that would be really helpful because I walk, and so I'm having to kind of calculate when I drive how long, I mean, and it's about a mile and a half from my house to Town Hall. So if I walk one way and then catch the bus back, which would be incredibly lazy, so I'm trying to walk both ways and do 3 miles instead of 1.5 miles. But, I mean, that would just be really helpful, and to have it maybe connected to the Parks and Rec maybe website, sort of integrating it. And my other question was, have you had any discussions with the Transportation Advisory Board with regards to, because a lot of the people on that board walk and bike to work and that kind of thing and exercise so much more than I do. So I was wondering, was there any synergy between those two groups?
I haven't contacted them yet.
Okay. That would be my suggestion.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been talked about in the Transportation Advisory Board that may fit really nicely is the idea of the ciclovia, or closing off the street between the town farmers market and Weaver Street on Sundays.
and then having there also be fitness activities. So it would be good to talk to you about that. I was also wanting to ask, do you still have more questions, Joel?
No.
About the case study on Estes Park Apartments. Uh-huh. Just what is that? What are y'all looking at exactly?
We mainly looked at state transportation policies that may affect right-of-way acquisition, kind of policies that would hinder sidewalk placement there.
On Estes Drive.
On Estes Drive Extension, yeah.
Not with apartments themselves.
Right. We just use them kind of as a model.
Are you done, Sam?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, I have a question also. I noticed one of the deliverables, it says increased staff capacity to engage in physical activity and health planning. Can you tell us what that was, or maybe it was just encompassed in your presentation?
Well, she's been lifting weights.
I didn't know if there was anything extra that would be done with staff, Jeff, as part of this. Or
we've been talking about actually possibly purchasing some pedometers for something for a project that you were talking about. But I don't necessarily know if it's actually funded by the grant.
I think one of the points under that bullet point is there's a number of trainings through this grant that are made available to the planning department staff, us, so that we can learn more about things like health impact assessments, which are kind of really new but are kind of ways that you can incorporate health and healthy lifestyles into providing information for making decisions, where in the past that's never been incorporated. Things like decisions about transportation, funding, or design of projects, complete streets, that in the past we didn't really think about, well, how will this encourage people to be active and, you know, get exercise as part of their day-to-day travel. But now, you know, health impact assessments, healthy lifestyles, and active transportation, that's really coming to the forefront in the discussion in the planning world, and obviously in some of the more health oriented thinking cities and towns across the country.
Thanks, that's helpful. I was wondering if the impact folks were in touch with the Sustain Foundation group that has done a lot of trail work and work with the Hispanic community on active living and health-related activity.
Pardon? What is the group called? The
Sustain Foundation.
No, is that out of Carborough or Chapel Hill?
Well, it's Chapel Hill Carborough, but they did extensive trail mapping, and they had a program where they were working with.
Did you get a website?
Yeah, they do, and they were working with Hispanic women and children, mm-hmm. And they've been fairly successful. So I can get the information to our clerk, to Kathy, and
that'd be great.
Okay, thanks.
If I could just add. Randy, to that point, it's a good point, because what we have done is we've tried to begin a discussion with El Centro España about how can we, you know, use this project to help with some of the goals that you have, and we have talked about things like, can we set up a focus group, mm-hmm. and, you know, for their clients who come into their office, and kind of ask them about, you know, what is their view. What are some difficult areas for them to walk around town and things like that? We haven't set up the focus group yet, but that's something that we'll continue
It would be great to get involved with the women who are already in the program. Yeah, okay.
That's a great idea.
Great, thanks.
Actually, my other question is, have you maybe considered working with the residents of Abbey Court? Because that's another place where you see people walking, and whether we should do some studies about making it safer to walk across the street or find some other routes to go to Morgan Creek, mm-hmm. and avail themselves of those opportunities as well.
I think that's a great idea. We haven't really specifically looked at targeting specific apartment complexes, but I think it's a good idea.
The other place that I know a lot of people come to Carver walking and biking from is apartments. The apartments along 54, and then what's the neighborhood above Whispering Hills and between Jones Ferry and Whispering Hills? There's a couple of informal connections to the apartments there.
Oh, you're talking about like Carolina Apartments. And
yeah, Heights. Like there are some informal connections there that would be interesting to see, especially in light of Mark's proposal to look into a cross way of crossing over 54. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to see.
Directly, there are informal routes directly off of 54?
They connect to the neighborhood. I'm blanking on that. I think it's like Queen or King Street, like is one of the streets in that neighborhood. It's off of Jones Ferry. Barnes.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments for staff on this? If not, do we have lessons?
We have attachment A. I'll move attachment A to for the update.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was messy, honestly. Thanks. That brings us to item D3, appointment to Owassa Board of Directors. Randy.
The Owassa Board of Directors, I just wanted to say that I've worked with Dana Stidham with the EAB Environmental Advisory Board, and she has some wonderful qualifications in addition to her background with water resources, also with environmental. I would support her representing us on the Owassa board.
I've read through these, and I was impressed by her in as much as she expressed interest in effectively representing our views and interests, especially as they relate to balancing growth with demand and some of the discussions we've had lately. I would find that valuable. I found that valuable to see that represented here.
Well, excuse me. I would propose that we reappoint Mr. Fushi. I think that there are a lot of technical people on the Owassa board, and quite frankly, I think we need people who've had experience on the Owassa board, and I think that some members on this board sort of misthink about what the purpose for a person being on the Owassa board. We appoint the person, and we are the people that set policy for growth. And if we don't like the way policy is set, we change that. And I don't want us to get in the position of picking people because they have a particular view that we either agree with or disagree with. But highly unlikely that we put anybody on there that we disagree with. But the purpose of somebody being on the Owassa board is to ensure that the people who live in Southern Orange County have potable water. And a lot of times we forget that. And then that the people in Southern Orange County have potable water to wash their clothes, cook their food, without it being as expensive as it continues to be. And so before we begin to think about the appointing of people because they have a particular view that we want advanced on the Owassa board, let us remember why it was created. It was created when the university owned a part of a system, Carver owned part of a system, Chapel Hill owned part of a system. And the purpose of this system is to provide potable water and to get rid of sewage. And I would suggest that, you know, we keep that in mind.
Is that a motion?
Well, it is a motion, but...
I think where we are is that I heard a motion, a second for Dana Stidham, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? I'm kind of taking a cue here, people who want to talk. Dan Coleman?
No, I was just going to ask, because I was... I thought Randy had made a motion, but I wasn't.
Yeah, that is...
Sure.
That is where we are. Are there some, Jackie?
I'm going to vote against Randy's motion, not because I have anything against or feel like the applicant could not do a wonderful job. I'm sure she could. I would support a motion to reappoint Mr. Fushi, who has served this community in many capacities, and would like to give him an opportunity to continue so. So with nothing to be said against Dana, I'm not going to vote for Randy's motion, and that's why.
To address some of Joel's points, I feel like Owassa board members are appointed by this board for the reason of our being able to have a say in the policies that Owassa takes on. And the differences that we're talking about don't speak to affordability or not, because the alternatives that we've been looking at are, and probably even the other ones are probably more affordable, I would say. It's important to, of course, recognize all the contributions that the, Mr. Fushi has given the town of Carver over time. I also find it valuable to bring more people in different perspectives in. I feel like the perspective that Mr. Fushi holds is very much represented already on the Owassa board, and the town of Carver's perspectives are not, and that's why I feel strongly in supporting Dana Stidham and second Randy's motion.
Did you have any comment you want to make on this situation? I think we're in a little bit of a difficult spot here, because I do think that, I have a tremendous amount of respect for all the things that Braxton Fushi has done for our community and in our community, both in recent years and long ago. And so it's just that it's a bit of a difficult spot. I feel like, while he has done an excellent job as a member of the Owassa board in terms of looking out for the ratepayers and carrying out his duties and responsibilities there, I feel like there are some points that that he and I, with respect to water policy, that he and I just don't really see eye to eye on, and I feel like it makes it difficult for. Makes for a more difficult relationship between Carborough town government and Owassa. Not that he's causing a problem, but just that we're simply not both trying to steer in the same direction. And so, as much as I appreciate all that he's done, from what I understand, I think it may be time for a change in the composition of that Owassa board. So,
Mark, I agree with you. I don't know Mr. Fushi any more than I know Ms. Stidham, other than to know that there are assignees and they represent our interests, or there are appointees to these boards, and just based on our conversation the last couple of weeks, it makes sense to me to maybe appoint someone who seems to be of the policy that we discussed a few weeks ago on this board.
Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I just want to echo what Mark said. I originally brought forward the motion to appoint Braxton 4 years ago, and was really pleased to do so because I knew him through all the involvements others have referred to. And I think for the first few years, it was a very enjoyable, well-functioning relationship between him and the town. But, starting with the issue on the emergency water and then with the Jordan Lake, these differences started to arise. And I guess the comment I want to make was, you know, when I heard Randy speak and then Joel speak earlier, that my reaction was, well, I agree with both of them. Mm-hmm. That I agree that there's a fiduciary responsibility that OWASA board members have to the functioning of the OWASA system, and that at the same time, we are the owners of OWASA, the three local governments are, and we exercise that ownership through our board appointments, and so it's important for us to have people who do represent our views. And I think, you know, it's a, you know, it's in part an interesting thing of timing, that if we hadn't had these issues in the last few months, then we might be having a different discussion tonight. But I think things are very clear at this point in time. Anyway, that's all.
Let me just say something. My comments aren't against Ms. Stedman. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we as the board, the town doesn't own OWASA. The ratepayers do. Be clear. The ratepayers do. So anything we do to the detriment of the ratepayers, we are not doing what we're supposed to be doing, being good stewards, long-term stewards.
I'm going to be very candid that, you know, Mr. Fushi is here. His tenure on board, Alderman, his tenure on OWASA, you know, with the utmost respect, I think you've done a wonderful service for the town. Greatly appreciate it. But I've got to be completely honest to say, back in March, when you presented with Mr. Stott, I got a very clear sense that you were not interested in reappointment, and that kind of, you know, that really informed my thinking. And I've got to say that I had been very much interested in the eagerness that Ms. Stidham has about taking on the appointment, and so I have to be honest about that.
We're ready for the questions.
He wants to say hi.
Okay.
Go ahead, Max.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I don't know where you got that idea from. The minute I got the letter from the town, I immediately filled it out and brought it in the next day. There's been no question about where I want to be reappointed or not, because that spoke for itself.
If I may, at the April 5th board meeting, we were talking about possibly our board meeting with you and William, yeah. And you said it would have to be before June because you would be here. We wouldn't be in the position after that. I think that's what people are understanding.
Well, at the end of the month, I won't be in the position. Because if y'all haven't reappointed me,
Well, that might have been a misunderstanding. I think
that's why I said that.
All right. Well,
that's why.
You can clarify.
That's why when I got the letter, we and William Charles, and that's the date we picked from the letter, and you said that date was not available, and I haven't heard anything else. So the army has always been in your court, not in my court, because we were willing to meet at any time. Well, while I'm here, Dan and I had a talk today. And we, at the OWASA board, does not have anything to do with growth, and that's all I've heard from this board, mainly Sammy and Dan. We don't have anything to do with growth. When a project comes before this board, whether y'all approve it or not, the first thing you do is you go to OWASA and say, do you have the capacity for this project? We will tell you yes or no. That's all we do.
I'm going to interrupt you a second because you're characterizing my views and you're wrong. The disagreements I've had with you and with the OWASA board are about two things. One is when to buy water in a drought. And the other is whether to drink water from Jordan Lake.
But well, I understand what you're saying about growth in the paper, Dan. That's what I'm telling that from. Okay?
You're mischaracterizing my views.
I'm not mischaracterizing
your
views. Guys, I think we have a motion before us.
I don't want to get into an argument. But that was published in the paper, and that's where I get that statement from.
Right.
What article was that? Just so I can confirm, because I don't know what you're referring
to. You have the article, so you should know which paper you sent it to, because it was an answer in the paper.
Okay. Well.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to argue. Let me say this too, and I'll be through.
Okay.
I appreciate the opportunity to serve. I've been on and dealing with the WASA pharmacy, I would say the last 30 years. I know the organization inside out. I know what we stand for. I know what we do. And what we do is not associated with any governmental decisions that the town made concerning anything, but water and sewer. I thank you for the opportunity for serving. If you don't know point of view, we're still friends. We can disagree. Mm-hmm. And this issue has not brought me to any stages in my life. But all thing I can say is that this issue will be discussed again in the fall. All right? Thank you.
Thanks, Braxton.
Thanks, Braxton.
Thanks, Braxton.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we appoint Dana Stidham. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Matter passes 5-2. Kirsten Brown. Okay. Brings us to item D4. Request to consider yard bombing project. Mr. Manager, did you have
there's really no presentation. We outlined after the last board conversation. We went back and really tried to simplify how this process could take place. And in the agenda abstract, you'll see a list of places/items where we felt like it would be appropriate for yard bombing to take place, and then suggested that rather than some sort of a form, that it would just be a situation where a request could be made. We can handle that administratively through the Arts Committee liaison who can distribute to the Arts Committee and to the appropriate staff. It should be a pretty quick turnaround, but I think there's a pretty good list of places that people would be able to choose from.
Okay.
When you sent this originally to us last week, I sent it to the chair of the Arts Committee, Chris Beecham, who thought it was fine. I haven't heard anything negative from any of the artists involved, so really appreciate it. Appreciate the simplicity. I did have one question. So if somebody wanted to do something else, will it be clear who they would need to contact, what they would need to tell them, and how long it would be before they'd hear back?
I think the first would be pretty easy, because I think Anita and I communicated today, probably since Kim Andrews is the liaison to the Arts Committee, that she'd be the clearinghouse for that. And I guess the turnaround time, Jackie, would really depend on what it was. I would think it'd be pretty quick.
So is Kim empowered to make that decision on her own?
No. It would go to, let's say it's a public works site, then it would go to George, and he'd say, well, yeah, this makes sense, or no, this doesn't make sense.
Okay, and so that, without the form, which I appreciate, that kind of cuts down on the paperwork, and so Kim could just call Dave or George.
Yeah, we'd like something in writing so we're clear, but it would just be, we want to yarn bomb
Steve on his last day of work. Yeah.
Don't give anybody ideas,
Jackie. Well, you wouldn't want to go. Steve.
I think that's your best idea.
I got Cutie be all yarned over. That would
be that's not the rules of yarn bombing. It has to be physical.
So I think that I think
make Steve into a sweater.
What we have before us is good, and I would like to move attachment
second.
A.
Right. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, that passes unanimously.
We have one matter of attorney-client privilege and two matters of attorney-client privilege and possibly one personnel matter
to discuss. We're going to take a 5-minute break and then entertain a motion to go into executive session. Speedy is called back to order. Is there a motion to go into a closed session to discuss two attorney-client privilege matters and one person?
Second.
Then moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
And somebody can get the gratitude of the board forever by turning off these hot lights.
You can keep George's size since he brought these.
I was going to say, if it's going to be...